welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Loose, the German language possession film, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
It is not your standard possession film.
No, it's generally true that if you've seen one possessed girl movie, you've seen them all. Broadly, obviously, they all exist in the shadow of The Exorcist, but of late, and still, this is going back, what, 15 years now at this point? They're really, I think, all in the mold of Exorcism of Emily Rose.
A bit, yeah.
I think that was kind of the turning point. That was a little bit of a watershed moment. Or if you go the found footage route, then you're more on, like, I don't know, Devil Inside territory.
Barf.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and this is coming from, I know I just said barf, but this is coming from someone who has a weakness for these sorts of movies, even when they're incredibly rote.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm naturally predisposed to that sort of thing. But yeah, no, I mean, the typical exorcism movie, there is always a priest conducting an exorcism. I guess This isn't an exorcism movie. I'm conflating them a bit. It's a possession movie. There really is no exorcism.
Yeah, they don't conduct an exorcism per se. What goes on is more in the nature of mesmerism and a kind of psychiatry, I guess.
Right. And, you know, the typical possession movie is very theatrical, a lot of gyrations and either CG or makeup distorting the possessed person's face. Usually it's a girl or a young woman.
Yeah. You want to talk about a possession movie that I barely remember, an exorcism movie that I scarcely remember at all, that would be The Rite
with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I bring this up because I was just about to say this subgenre has gotten steeped in tropes, mired in tropes, you might even say, one of which is that the exorcist or exorcists always have some personal baggage that comes to bear.
They're on the outs.
Yeah, right.
With the church.
They're just about always questioning their faith. Only thing that I remember about that movie is that I think at one point Anthony Hopkins spits up a rusty nail. I remember thinking that was kind of a striking image. This is why we watch movies like this, because they always have a glimmer of something in there somewhere. But it's like that scene in Jurassic Park where they go sifting through the man-sized pile of dinosaur feces. Looking for the clue.
That's one big pile of shit.
To what's making the Triceratops sick.
Right. What's making us sick with the willingness to watch possession movie after possession movie. Let's find the Anthony Hopkins throwing up rusty nails.
Exactly. That's why we're here, folks.
So yeah, that's the general possession movie framework. Always ends with a big climactic exorcism.
Yep. Girl goes scrambling up the walls, contorting herself in all kinds of wacky positions, speaking maybe backwards, maybe in Latin, maybe both.
Or, you know, Aramaic.
Yeah,
or
some language in which she was not fluent.
Right. It's usually old language, often like disused language.
Mm-hmm.
So I front load all this by saying Loose really doesn't have many of these tropes.
And the ones that it does have are implemented weirdly.
Yes.
In a sort of novel way.
Right. And the other thing about Loose that's interesting is that, not including the credits, which only add a few minutes, as most do, the film is 66 minutes long. It's very brief.
It also has, it takes place mostly in one location, and everything preceding that is, I mean, I'll talk about this more after the break, a little bit of a thankless prologue. You know, I mean, it's not like totally expendable or perfunctory, but it's not like, I mean, I felt you could have almost distilled this movie down into just the one setting and you would have had an even, you know, you had a sub feature length movie that was really lean and tight. If you found a way to chop 20 minutes off of this thing, it could be a segment from a really offbeat, strong anthology horror movie,
right?
Like three sequences in it of 40-ish minutes. That's kind of the vibe that I got from it. It's a feature-length movie, but it would not be a novel. It would be a short story if you wrote it down.
Perhaps a novella,
right?
So, anyway, the basic premise is that a taxi driver in Germany, a Chilean taxi driver in Germany named Luz. L-U-Z, she kind of bumps into a demon, basically.
Basically.
And spends the rest of the movie kind of fleeing. But it's not it's absolutely not linear. Like, time is incredibly fucky. Perspectives are screwy. So hopefully our synopsis is relatively coherent. I think we'll manage, but it might be a bit all over the place.
I'm leery of reading between the lines. Last episode really shook my confidence when I projected a whole subplot onto the movie that was not there. A whole like dramatic, thematic through line.
You see, Luce is really about Luce's dead mother, who was a nun after she gave birth to her, or before, or something. Yeah, no. We'll attempt to avoid extra speculation where possible.
Yeah, well, Luce has enough going on that maybe I didn't feel the pressure that I felt while watching The Gallows Act 2
to
voice something onto the screen just to give myself something to chew on. Yeah,
that film was pretty empty, so fair enough.
We open with a long shot in every sense, you know, duration-wise, and we're a long distance from its subjects.
Yes. There's a long take and a wide shot.
Correct. There is a night watchman or a receptionist, a guy sitting at a desk in a kind of drab office. There's a vending machine on the wall opposite him. Someone, we later find out to be Luce, walks into the room, mills about for a moment.
And when we say a moment, we mean like a minute. That's the incredible thing about how short this movie is. This opening where not a lot happens until the last like 10 seconds of the opening. It's very, very sedate. It's weird.
Yeah, so Luz mills around for a spell, gets something from the vending machine, or fiddles with the vending machine at any rate. And then, as you just said, something happens, although that something is just a character raising their voice. You know, it's not exactly, you know, you see a shot like this and you expect there to be some kind of whoa at the end.
Sure.
Because why else would it be so static? You know,
And there kind of is in the form of the smash cut to the title.
Yeah, it's like a Cabin in the Woods style title drop where the title itself is meant to rattle your bones a little bit. But no, I mean, this is basically not, if you've seen Exorcist 3, that there's a shot in a hospital hallway. That's kind of the gold standard for this sort of thing. And that's what I was expecting going into this. It's not how it plays out. Luz approaches the desk, asks the guy, you know, is this really what you want to do with your life? Is this really what you want?
And then sort of just repeats herself louder.
Yeah. Boom. Luz. We get a scene in a tavern, I guess, club.
Yeah, some kind of, well, it's a bar, but it's weird. It's almost like, I don't know how to describe it. It's very brightly lit for a bar. Like, typically a scene like this, it'd be dim mood lighting. In here, it's almost kind of sterile.
Yeah, well, it's like, it looks like a dingy hospital.
it's a dingy hospital bar, which is not a thing.
Or like a bar in a Soviet airport. Like that's,
yes.
That's kind of...
You fucking nailed it.
The lighting...
must be East Germany.
Yeah, right. The lighting looks... It's a recipe for a hangover. You feel hungover just sitting in there with them. And the guy that the shot is centering on is disheveled. He's got like a sweaty brow. He looks like he's on a bender. And he's talking to a woman who is also unkempt, is constantly sniffing coke, I guess. Some white powdery substance. And they are talking about her history with Luz and how they met at a Chilean Catholic school, a girls' school.
Boarding school, yeah.
Yeah, and how they conducted a ritual on a classmate of theirs who believed that she was pregnant, and it ended fatally.
Mm-hmm.
And this all comes out in a slow drip because they're interrupting one another, and there are kind of, not, I don't want to say pointless digressions, but for our purposes now, at this moment, irrelevant, you know, just like weird character quirks keep interfering with the exposition. I say interfering, I actually like that kind of friction, because if it's nothing but raw, undiluted exposition, it feels like, you know, an exposition dump, which is generally unwelcome.
Yeah. And this is also intercut with, there's a scene of Luce in a hallway where she sits down and she starts reciting this fucked up prayer, basically.
Yeah, this weird, it's like a delinquent schoolboy litany. It's like a Catholic school kid razzing the man upstairs.
Yeah, it's like a garbage dump Our Father.
But it's like, it's fairly milquetoast for the most part. And then at the end, there's one F-bomb. Let us something, something, and fuck the son of Mary.
Right.
But that's as hardcore as it gets.
Yeah, because it opens with, like,
our father.
Why art thou a dick?
Why art thou a dick? Thy creation stinks, I think, is one of the lines. So it's funny because I'm always complaining about how demons in horror movies have yet to attain the standard set by the demon in The Exorcist, right, who spouts the most hateful, odious crap you've ever heard. You know, your mother sucks cocks in hell. Karis, you faithless swine or slime. I can never get it right. Either way, this is an awful thing to say to somebody. And again, that has to do with the priest, Karis's baggage. That trope kind of is cemented with that movie. Also something that movie does better than any of its imitators.
True.
So it's funny that Luz, the film, and Luz, the character, does not even try. Does not come out guns blazing trying to out profanity Pazuzu, the demon from The Exorcist, but just does it in this weirdly like prepubescent kind of way. But that still has, it sounds silly the first time you hear it, and indeed the second time you hear it, but it's repeated often enough in this movie that it does gradually accrue a surprising amount of weight, I found.
Right.
Just through sheer repetition. And really, it's substance over style, I think. I mean, the gist is the same as your mother sucks cocks in hell. I mean, it's Paradise Lost as written by an 11-year-old.
Right. Well, and that's what also makes it diegetically sensible.
Right.
Because
this is a mantra that she's probably been repeating since she was...
It dates back to the Catholic
school. A Catholic schoolgirl. Right, exactly.
So it makes perfect sense. So we see her doing that. And then meanwhile, the bar scene has sort of an interesting dynamic because it starts out with the woman at the other end of the bar trying to get this guy's attention. And he's very standoffish at first. And she's trying to find, like, hey, you know, you have a pager, are you a doctor? And eventually sidles over to him. And the power structure in this conversation sort of gradually shifts. Because at first it's her trying to drag talk out of him. And then eventually the booze starts flowing faster and faster. And, you know, the drugs for that matter. And suddenly she's in the driver's seat and he's like trying to chime in and
he can't get a word in edgewise.
Yeah, she even chides him for interrupting.
Yeah.
And yeah, we get this whole backstory of what happened at the girls' school. Apparently Luz had sort of a potent power of suggestion. She claimed to smell rotten fish one time in the cafeteria and made herself throw up, like stuck a finger down her throat. And then mass hysteria took place.
Right.
Basically, all the girls, well, not all the girls, but a bunch of them all got sick and got fevers and were all throwing up. And the school had the food checked and the kitchen and the gas lines, and there was nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm. See, I initially thought that was going a different way. I thought, because she leads into this by saying, oh, Luz has always had powers. I thought that it was like an oracular thing where she knew that the fish was going to be tainted.
Right.
She said, I smelled rotten fish, and then she makes herself throw up, and then a bunch of girls fall ill. But yeah, I think that it's not even open to interpretation. It's not much of a chicken or the egg thing. I think the film does come down on the side of her inducing this mass hysteria in people.
Yeah. And so in keeping with this power of suggestion, she also convinces this girl, Margarita, her roommate, that she is pregnant. And then they have to conduct some kind of...
occult abortion, I think?
It's just some kind of ritual. And, you know, it's not clear what the trappings of an exorcism have to do with a pregnancy, unless you assume the pregnancy is the Antichrist. I guess the idea being, you know, if she was a good Catholic schoolgirl and she never fooled around, if she's suddenly pregnant and she doesn't know how, maybe it's the Antichrist, like the virgin birth in the wrong direction.
Right, the opposite of an immaculate conception. It's also possible that if she has been getting up to hanky-panky, that she would want to terminate it just because she is a Catholic schoolgirl who could be ostracized or worse.
Sure, but that's where it gets confusing as to what an exorcism has to do with it. But anyway, they conduct this ritual, you know, circle of salt, candles, and the woman in the bar, Nora, is saying how, like, she was there, and then the janitor walked in on us, and I was dragged out, and Margarita ended up committing suicide, and Luz was expelled, and I lost track of her until I met her here in Germany tonight.
Driving a cab.
And yeah, you know, I wanted to get your input as a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, because that's what he ends up volunteering is his job, his specific brand of medicine. And you know, I wanted to get your input because she just jumped out of our cab while it was moving.
Mm-hmm. And this account is sort of called into question later on, but more on that in due time.
Right.
They go into the bathroom together. It's not really clear why. I mean, they both look strung out. But she's also just doing coke out in the open. So you would like take refuge in a bathroom stall so you can do something illicit. I mean, I guess they do. I don't know. It's not really clear what happens. She says, "Give me your hand." And then they exchange, I guess, a handshake, but it's out of frame. So it's not even clear what's going on. And he starts seizing.
Well, first, the handshake gets more and more vigorous. It looks more like a hand job.
Right. I thought that, okay, this is going in my like personal pantheon of like angry hand job scenes. It's like up there with the master.
Yeah.
There are others. I don't know why. I have a carefully curated list. Don't ask me why. But the rest of them escape me for now. Master was kind of the ne plus ultra, although if that is what's happening in this scene, then it has to be in the running. But yeah, no, I my mind went to the same place.
Well, because the other feature of this bar conversation is that even more than just woman meets man in bar, it's got all the trappings of a seduction.
Right.
And you expect that, okay, yeah, maybe they're going to the bathroom to do some drugs, but they may very well also be planning to fuck.
Right. Or and possibly because one or both of them are addicts, there's going to be a kind of sleazy transactional element to it. It could play out in all manner of skeezy ways. You're not sure exactly what's going on. And then you become even less sure once he starts spasming.
It's just turns into, to bring up this turn of phrase again, a vibrating gargoyle.
Yes, although no CGI elements. It's all
just a dude shaking his head really
physical
hard.
Physical performance, yeah. It does look a bit like a wet chihuahua, though, so I take your point. And then she kisses him, and I don't know if y'all did this when you were kids at any point, or if you saw like a friend of yours do this. If you like wrap your lips around a flashlight that's on and you get like the glow coming through the thin skin of your cheeks,
right?
Like if you like put a flashlight on the palm of your hand, you can kind of see your bones,
right?
That kind of light starts emanating when they lock lips. It looks like
or even like before,
yeah,
it's coming out. And then yeah, they both vibrate some more, and then she falls to the ground dead. Like, she is completely motionless, and, like, eyes are open.
Yeah, it looks like something has abandoned her vessel, her, like, flesh vessel, and moved into him.
And sure enough, up to this point, he has been getting steadily more intoxicated, to the point where, like, he had received a page, and he's like, oh, fuck, I gotta go, and he's falling all over himself, but now he's, like, perfectly composed.
Right. So, here begins the movie proper. This is when we get to the setting where we spend basically the remainder of the film. I mean, there are cutaways which are kind of subjective, inception-y, mind palace constructions. But I think we are just bound to this location for basically the rest of the movie's runtime, which, like I said earlier, lends it that kind of like one segment in an anthology kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Could have been more of a locked room setup if they had found a way to dispense with everything we've already related.
Right. It's like an interrogation auditorium, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
it's
like
clearly a room for like interviews and interrogations, but it's a huge space.
Yeah, it's like a warehouse that was repurposed as a lecture hall. Like, there's a bunch of folding chairs set up, most of which go unused because the movie has a very small cast. It's just the doctor, whose name is Rossini, Nora, the woman who approaches him in the Soviet airport bar, Luz herself, who they have acquired somehow.
Well, the beginning of the movie is her walking into the police station.
Right.
It's not clear at that time, but you figure it out because at the end, she walks out of the amphitheater,
right,
and it's the same.
Yes.
Yeah. Same location.
Right, exactly. So, the closing shot of this film is very much like the opening shot. It bookends it, the same framing.
Yeah, so she has basically just shown up at the police station, and they're trying to get information out of her.
Right.
So there's those three characters.
Plus a policewoman and a translator.
Yeah. He spends pretty much the entire stretch of runtime that he's in a ADR cabinet. If
he's that like makes he's sense. Like a he's, translation DJ.
He's in a recording box. And yeah, he's translating because Luce does speak German and is speaking it from time to time, but she also speaks a lot of Spanish, and the cop does not speak Spanish. And for that matter, neither does Rossini, except when he's no longer Rossini.
Right.
Which is really for most of the movie.
Right. So he, Rossini, hypnotizes Luz. You know, you're getting very sleepy, that kind of thing. She sort of collapses against him and cut to black. And we linger on a totally black, blank screen for some time. We hear their voices as he's sort of navigating through this trance state that he's inducing. He's kind of pulling her deeper into it. He says, "You're in your cab. What would a blind man hear if he was in your cab?" And now sounds start creeping in. Traffic and such, foot traffic.
Yeah, and it cuts back to Luce in one of these folding chairs. They've set up four folding chairs like a cab.
It took me back to my forensics days, actually. It's a weird pantomime that plays out. It's weirdly compelling, actually. If you've seen Dogville, you have some idea of how this plays out, because it is just, it creates, I mean, you spend a lot of time in an actual cab in Luz's memory, but a lot of the time you're just in this weird auditorium, warehouse, lecture hall, police station.
Yeah, and the first, 5 minutes straight, pretty much, is her pantomiming everything she, taking out a cigarette, lighting the cigarette.
Yeah, getting out of the cab, opening the trunk, putting luggage in the trunk.
And we get all of the foley for all that stuff played over the pantomime. So
right.
It's laying the groundwork for just straight up Mind Palace flashbacks.
Right. One cute detail. The only physical prop that I can remember is they have
a rear view mirror
mounted on a tripod for her to fuss with when she's sitting in the driver's seat, which is in fact just a folding chair. I thought that was pretty funny. No rear view mirror jump scares this time around.
No, good. Thank God.
Yeah, no, we're not another Gallows Act 2 situation. So yeah, I mean, she is completely bought into the fiction that he's created. She puts music on the radio and starts moving and grooving and picks up a passenger in the form of Nora, who is she actually physically present, or is that just, or is she just a construct?
She's just a construct.
Okay.
Because I can't say anything definitively about this movie, because, again, perspectives are screwy and time is messed up, particularly when it gets into this stretch of the movie where they're just cutting back and forth between the auditorium and her mind palace. You know, it's not clear exactly what's going on, but I'm fairly confident that Nora is dead in the Soviet airport bar bathroom.
What a way to go.
So the construct of her, we see her standing in the auditorium as part of this pantomime.
But it also shortly becomes clear that Rossini has brought costumes along with which to portray different people to get different reactions out of his patient.
Right. Well, it's not immediately. He doesn't trot that out for a good 20, 25 minutes. He only really starts using costumes as we get to the climax.
Right. Once the shit kind of hits the fan a little bit more, although we are already kind of ramping up to that. We get a version of the interaction that Nora and Luz had in the cab. Rather than Luz ladybirding out of the car while it's in motion, Nora instigates a crash by grabbing her necklace. And we see this. We see Luz in the folding chair with her necklace poltergeisting off of her neck as though someone were yanking on it.
Right.
So they kind of come to a screeching halt, and this was precipitated by them getting into an argument about Margarita, their classmate, who died on Luz's watch.
Yeah, and don't you feel guilty? And this, in turn, had been precipitated by, basically, Nora in this scene is kind of like a self-obsessed yammerer, I guess, for lack of a better phrase.
She was in the bar scene to an extent, too, once she built up some momentum.
But that felt more purposeful. Here, she's basically made into one of those people who takes every conversation as an excuse to talk about the mundane events of their life.
Right.
Like, she asks Luce, hey, is being a cab driver dangerous? And Luce doesn't really have time to respond before, speaking of dangerous. like this crazy guy was on my flight and he had to be thrown off by the police.
Speaking of this thing that I just brought up.
Right, exactly.
Artfully segue into what I actually wanted to talk about.
But yeah, as they're arguing about Margarita, Luz breaks out the unholy Our Father, the prepubescent litany.
Yes, the mild blasphemy.
And Nora's getting steadily more distraught because this is the same stuff that was said during the ritual that ended eventually with Margarita committing suicide.
No one is more distraught than the translation DJ.
Oh.
However, he refuses to even repeat some of the stuff that he's hearing.
I won't translate it. She blasphemed again. I don't need to say that again. And the cop is just like, you shitting me? You know, do your job.
Right.
I get it. You like Jesus, but come on, keep it together.
Yeah, and court stenographers can't get finicky about that sort of thing.
Right.
Or repeat whatever they're told.
So this all, again, culminates in this crash. And from there, my theory, and your theory may be different when you watch Luz. It's possible that Matt's theory is different. We haven't really discussed any of this at all.
I don't know that I even really formulated one. I just kind of took it all in stride, or
sure,
at least endeavored to.
But my theory is that Luz, dating back to Catholic school, she has sort of dabbled in demonology,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, black magic and whatnot, just as sort of a lark, as like a fuck you to authority and so forth. And when she did this during the ritual that led to the suicide, she actually managed to catch the attention of a demon, and she didn't really do it on purpose.
Uh-huh.
But kind of since then, it's been trying to catch up to her. There's a lot of lines about early on in like the bar scene where Nora slash the demon, because she's the demon during that entire stretch, basically, is talking about how I've been trying to find her.
I haven't seen
her in so long, and it all makes sense in this context that comes later. So my theory is that the crash basically went as follows. Luz got pissed off at her school friend, who wasn't really much of a friend and she didn't like very much, being a bit of a bitch, and just decided to throw back some spooky blasphemy. Nora gets upset, as it turns out, justifiably so. She eventually gets so freaked out that she tries to, like, not really strangle Luz with her necklace, but kind of
make,
like,
her stop talking.
Make her stop. This induces the crash. And then at some point during or immediately after the crash, the summoning is complete. The demon has possessed Nora,
mm-hmm,
and Luz gets away and gets to the police station. And since then, the demon has been trying to get to her. That's why it propositions basically the doctor in the bar,
uh-huh,
and then takes possession of him and then has,
sure,
him conducting
he has
all
the,
of this.
He has the credentials to get into the police station.
And also is directly interacting with her,
uh-huh,
because that's his job. It's not even just like he has to get through the front door and then track her down. It's,
right,
it's, they're put right into contact. So,
yeah, intimate, like psychiatric contact, which, you know, facilitates whatever demonic bond is trying to be. No, I think that timeline is... it definitely holds up to my scrutiny.
Right.
So,
and
well done.
Thank you. As Matt indicated, the doctor slash the demon has come with costumes. He has torn off his clothing and puts on this frilly short dress slash negligee kind of thing, and then a white leather jacket. And these were the clothes that Nora was wearing in the bar and that he appeared to have taken from her then, although it wasn't clear at the time exactly,
yeah,
what he was taking. And it's also around this time that the translator says fuck that and like pulls down a shade.
He yanks down his nope curtain and just stays in his box, refuses to obviously translate anything else that's going on, refuses to engage with it at all. And it's just it would have been a funny moment no matter what, but it's doubly funny knowing that he was so easily scandalized by Jesus Christ is a butthole, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
The exactly. Virgin Mary was an armpit. It's like, you know, if that's enough to really shake him, then, yeah, obviously seeing all of this go down is going to, yeah, make him want to get the fuck out of Dodge.
Yeah.
The other thing that transpires here is the doctor demon, where we see him from behind, so it's not really clear what's going on. He appears to Chinatown himself. He, like, forces a nosebleed and then uses the blood to, like, grease back his hair in order to look like he's just emerged from a car wreck, I guess, right, in order to, again, facilitate this pantomime.
Right. So now he's in the quote-unquote backseat of the quote-unquote cab, and then Luce does, like, somehow they're driving again. And this is where it gets a little more wibbly-wobbly.
Yeah, there's a Rashomon element at play here, just because, like, Nora's account of what the vehicular mishap even was is very different from what plays out here. So it's hard to say how much of this is memory and how much of it is just a new construction.
Right. So we think Luce jumps out of the car at this point and gets away. And meanwhile, in the auditorium, while the present, I guess, is happening, a smoke machine has been activated.
Yeah, well, it happens. It starts creeping in after the crash as though it were fumes spilling out from under a caved-in hood or
right,
something. But it is, yeah, it's creeping into the real world. And we know that it's really happening because the policewoman is not taking kindly to it. And she is largely standing at a remove from all of the kind of Inception-y Mind Palace stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
She's our most objective pair of eyes, I think, in this room, now that the translator is not looking at what's happening.
Right. Well, we've actually, now I'm realizing that we've kind of jumbled these events around, and I knew it was going to happen eventually, but at one point, the doctor, who has, like, kept his human mask on, more or less, all this time.
Oh, yeah, I knew we'd elided this, but I wanted to get to it sooner or later, so now's as good a time as any.
He shows up with, like, milky cataract eyes, with his entire hand over the cop's face, and the translator guy is still watching at this point, because this is when the shit hits the fan for him. He's like, oh, this guy is a demon.
This is right before he nopes out. Yeah,
prior to this, the cop is sort of looking around and waving a gun, or maybe that happens when
that happens later.
Okay, that happens later when she, like, briefly snaps out of it. Right. Okay, so we get a little bit more of the hypnosis. And again, the doctor is wearing the negligee and the jacket, and he hears some knocking, and he's very annoyed, and he tells Luz, like, don't move, stay right there. And she, like, starts shouting, like, stay where? She's very confused. And he goes over to the booth where the translator is and opens the door, and then the translator goes hard. Just, like, he's holding up a big reel-to-reel recorder and just bashes the dude in the face, which appears to break the spell for a minute. And, like, yeah, as I was saying earlier, the cop kind of comes to her senses because this, like, face grabbing was part of a hypnosis where the demon said something along the lines of, I'll need you to do me a favor in a little while. And there's even a time where she, like, shows up in the middle of the hypnosis of Luz, and then he's like, no, it's not time yet. And then, like, walks her back into the smoke. Anyway, the end of the hypnosis doesn't really last very long.
No.
As it turns out.
The demon reasserts control. And again, we are inferring a lot of this. In a normal possession movie, all of this would be more explicit. There'd be another priest, like a peripheral character off to the side, commentating like a fucking sports broadcaster. You know, like, oh no, now the demon has the upper hand. We're really meant to infer a lot of this stuff. And I think it's the correct inference, but nonetheless, it's kind of just taken completely at face value. It's just a group of people in a room behaving very strangely.
Right.
There's never any, like, demon POV shots where you see through a weird filter it body hopping or anything like that. It's all just down to the actor's body language and occasionally milky white contacts.
Right. There's a little bit more back and forth. And basically this all culminates with the doctor / demon who has been wounded, apparently, by getting hit in the face with a reel-to-reel recorder. Go figure. He has stumbled into the back seat of the cab. And we've also elided this part. He has periodically also taken the form of Margarita.
Yes.
Which makes everything even more wibbly-wobbly.
Yes, Margarita nude, as she was when she was in the salt circle during the ritual.
And he/she/it is speaking to Luz, who's sitting in the quote-unquote front passenger seat, saying, like, I love you, basically. And they get closer and closer together, and then the demon pounces, basically.
They lock lips. It plays out very much like the kiss in the bathroom stall.
Except without the glowing mouth light.
Right, weirdly, but
so but
Luz does convulse, not as violently as the doctor did, but there's a sort of epileptic fit, and once again we've ditched our old flesh vessel.
But it's weird though, because the way she reacts afterwards, she's like sort of panically like, oh no, starts kissing Margarita slash the doctor again, even after lifeless, basically. And the behavior is not quite the same as it was from the doctor after he gets possessed. And plus, you know, you don't have the mouth light and you think, like, did she win? Like, did it try and take her over and then she kept it off and then it's just kind of evaporated back into the ether? As it turns out, no, pretty definitively, because we are back in the wide long take in the lobby.
We hear at first just Foley fumbling noises. It sounds like, you know, like that kind of thing.
Right.
I hope that the microphone picked that up. I imagine it did. I just...
Little scratchy rumblies.
Yeah, right. And we assume that this is happening in the sound booth. And then after the guy gets his bearings, the translator, he starts saying, please, you know, for the love of God, don't let it get away. Don't let it escape.
I thought it was the doctor. It wasn't. I think the translator has just kind of like dropped off the face of the earth. He just kind of, like, I don't know if he ran out after he.
He very well might have, because we don't see him after that. I think it would be in keeping with his character for him to bail at the first opportunity.
Nope the fuck out in the face of demons. But yeah, so I think it's the doctor, and he's trying to talk to the cop on the radio and saying, like, don't let it out. You can't let it out. And this is where we see this is the favor. The cop escorts Luz, possessed by the demon, out and, like, gets the paperwork and signs it and lets her go. All while the doctor or whoever it is just desperately crying, like, shoot, don't let it leave.
Yeah.
And that's the movie.
Yeah, that's the movie. A tight, 60-odd minutes.
More than half of which we've taken up just in describing it.
Well, that's the nature of the beast here on the Shock Doctors podcast. More after the break.
Your master's a wizard, sir.
Luz.
Du musst wissen, meine Freundin hat eine ganz besondere Begabung.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/Shock Doctors Pod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
And we're back. So, Matt, what do you got for us?
So, one of the tropes associated with this genre or subgenre that's as old as the hills, which we talked about at the top of the episode, is that the victim speaks in a language that is unknown to them fluently. Sometimes multiple languages in the span of a minute because the demon is showing off.
Mm-hmm.
As usually, there's also an element of these movies where the priest, despite being a man of the cloth, is also skeptical. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, real possessions are so rare.
You gotta have this and this and this.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of red tape. which is why you like the one thing that we liked about Devil Inside, I think you particularly kind of glommed onto it, is the idea that they're rogue exorcists.
Yeah, they're renegade
exorcists,
like, not,
who don't play by the rules.
Not sanctioned by the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, that literally the only cool thing about that trash film.
It's quite bad. Again, we're sifting through dino dung looking for the one thing that's worth salvaging. So this movie plays with that sort of melting pot of language in an interesting way, because it's about an immigrant in Germany, and it's a polyglot piece. I mean, there's a translator present, for Christ's sake, to make sure that everyone knows what everyone else is saying. The characters lapse in and out of different languages, and this is more mundane in this setting because the characters are just multilingual by necessity.
Right. It's mostly German and Spanish, and then there's English from time to time.
Yeah.
And really the only nod in the direction of the paranormal in terms of speaking in tongues or what have you is when I think it's the cop who asks the doctor.
Since when did you speak Spanish?
And he says, in Spanish.
Since it was invented.
Right. And so we get that in Spanish, and there's no subtitles. I don't know if the particular subtitle track we got was just particularly deft, or if that's how it was planned to be, but we didn't get a translation.
Right.
And this happens multiple times. We didn't get a translation, and then we got the guy giving the German translation, and we got English subtitles for that. And so we get this Spanish line, and then it's this dude saying, since it was invented. And that's when the shit really hits the fan for the translator guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he literally, like, slams his back into the back of the booth.
Yeah.
Just, like, scrambling away. So this is, like, the devil.
There's something really delicious about the stock, fearful translator. I mean, like, I always think of Jason Isaacs in Event Horizon. You know, like, saying what the Latin means.
Right.
I can't even remember what it was, but, you know, some kind of despairing, ominous missive from the crew of the ghost ship.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun little horror trope that I'm rather partial to. And in this movie, they've built a whole character around that idea, not just one scene. So that's pretty awesome. But yeah, no, it's a multilingual movie, and the cultural and language barriers between the characters gives the movie a kind of heft that's missing from a lot of Exorcist movies. I mean, American Exorcist movies, you know, we're such a, I mean, I'm no better. I'm a monolingual, you know, American pig ignorant asshole. I don't speak a word of most any other language. I have a slow-witted elementary schooler's grasp of Spanish. But not even. I think my Spanish has deteriorated a lot in the last 10 years or so. So I'm no better. But American Exorcist movies kind of traffic in this idea that hearing any foreign language is just innately scary. You know, it's like as soon as the possessed girl starts speaking French, it's like, oh, she's not supposed to know that. Why would she know that? You know, and usually it's because she's from some like provincial background or something. You know, it has to do with her lack of education or something.
Right.
How could she have possibly? And then she gets into the Latin and the Aramaic and what have you.
Yeah.
But I think that that's kind of an American phenomenon, that we expect you to be monolingual till proved otherwise. Whereas
right.
in this movie, the soup that they're swimming in is kind of cloudier, and it makes all of the demon flexing its language muscles a little bit more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I talked about this at the beginning of the episode in one sense, that this movie is super low-key relative to your typical, again, as Matt said, American possession movie.
And again, the all-time great Exorcist movie is an American joint. You
sure.
know, so I'm not.
Yeah, this isn't. You know, this isn't a knock on the whole genre per se. It's a knock on what has become rote and the particular bog standard or worse run of movies of that kind. But it gets more theatrical near the end with the doctor putting on a negligee and giving himself a nosebleed and the smoke and so forth.
Right.
But for the first 45 to 50 minutes, like Matt was saying, it's basically just people in a room talking to each other, behaving a little bit strangely. It's a relatively tame, like, police interview.
Right.
And that's not really something I've ever seen before.
Well, in whole, long, long running cop shows, their bread and butter is the interrogation scene. It's
sure.
just kind of an innately cinematic device. And when you pair it with demonic possession and add in the hypnotherapy element, yeah, it's really novel. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like it, and I was really taken with it. Basically, as soon as they get into the police station, they being the whole gang. I mean, not just the opening shot set in the lobby of the police station.
Yeah.
The physical performances of the whole cast are really excellent, and since several of them have to portray being possessed by the same entity, they must have conferred with one another. I mean, obviously they're all being directed by the same director, probably being coached and told to behave the same way, but they do create an admirable kind of continuity among the four or five of them that wind up harboring, or I think just three of them that wind up harboring the demon at various points.
Right.
And again, it's all done with just physical mannerisms.
Yeah, the extent of it, just the doctor wears the colored contacts at one point. Like,
right.
There's no CG. There's really not even makeup except for fake blood.
Even the necklace coming off the back of the neck, poltergeisting, I think is the term that I coined when during the pantomimed car crash. Even that looks like it was done with a stiff piece of metal rather
right.
than like a computer generated necklace. You know,
it looks very practical.
Yeah.
And we're all for that because, again, another feature of the last 10 or 15 years of American possession movies has been a steadily greater and greater reliance on CG involving such things as my bête noir cloud of black flies and,
yeah.
you know,
it is a,
things
a,
of that nature.
A veritable biblical plague of CGI flies swarming around this genre. We griped about that in the blanking of first name, last name that I can never remember. The one in the morgue.
Possession of
Hannah Grace.
Hannah Grace.
Yes.
I nearly said Exorcism of Emily Rose.
That's definitely where that started, or
yeah.
at least where it was codified.
Right.
Credit where it's due, the Jennifer Carpenter, is that her
yeah.
name? Jennifer Carpenter, who plays Emily Rose, I don't remember a ton of, there's like gratuitous CGI in that movie when she's getting jump scared by like stretchy mouth Edvard Munch demons.
Right.
But her face is just her face, and she contorts it in ways that look fucking demented, and it's a really, really...
And her body, too, for
yeah,
that matter.
Those it's a great are... performance.
Whereas, again, a lot of the CG in most of these movies also involves, like, bones moving in ways that are impossible, even
right.
if you're, like, triple-jointed.
Uh-huh.
And there's none of that here either, which is refreshing.
Yeah, this movie's a breath of fresh air in all kinds of ways. Just on the subject of thrashing around, as Emily Rose does, and which is par for the course in movies like this, the kiss in the bathroom and the fit that it induces in the doctor reminded me of, it's not as balls to the wall, but it reminded me of the kind of thing you'd get in Possession.
Okay.
Like Isabel Ajani.
Sam Neill, yeah.
Yeah, right. Where her freak out in the tube station or whatever it is, the underground, when she starts hurling herself bodily hither and yon and like beating her brains out against the walls and the floor.
Mm-hmm.
It never escalates to quite that pitch of intensity. But when he starts seizing, I mean, you really fear for the guy. I mean, if you saw someone doing that on the street, you would know it was the real deal, or you would be convinced that it was.
Sure.
He really looks like he's having some kind of serious brain chemistry crisis right in front of you. And all of the fits in this movie are credible in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably thinking of Possession just because this whole movie has a kind of chilly Euro horror vibe to
yeah,
it. It also reminded me of Daughters of Darkness
okay,
in that
sure.
way, which I wasn't in love with. It has a fucking great ending that kind of upended my whole opinion of it. But it's even artier, I would say, than this movie. It's all to do with, you know, again, that chilly European kind of atmosphere. And what else did this movie remind me of? The bar scene, on the subject of, you know, art house European stuff, the scene in the bar reminded me more than anything of the kind of exchange you'd get in a Rainer Werner Fassbinder movie.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen, and this was called to mind for two reasons. I mean, he was an addict, and a lot of his characters are people who exist on the margins. They're, you know, junkies or transgender people or immigrants or what have you. He made probably, almost certainly, if we're just talking about Germany, like the definitive immigrant experience in Germany movie, which is Ali, Fear Eats the Soul. It's 74, I want to say. And it's a kind of remake of the Douglas Sirk movie, All That Heaven Allows. It's about a relationship with a serious age gap, older woman, younger man. And the man, in his telling, is a Moroccan migrant worker.
Mm-hmm.
And so their relationship is taboo for any number of reasons.
Sure.
Ali is not even the character's name. It's a pejorative that's like, everyone just calls him Ali because, you know,
sure.
look at him. It's a kind of racial slur that he just sticks to him like glue, and everyone who looks like him. It's a great movie, and what I was talking about earlier with this movie being kind of a polyglot piece,
mm-hmm.
it's that inevitably, and let me come right out and say it, Luz is wearing for the whole movie a baseball cap that backwards on her head that says Chile. It's literally branded on the back of her head. Now, obviously, this is a hat that she elected to wear, so it's an identity that she's embraced. However, the fact that it's every time you're looking at the back of her head, she's wearing like a label telling you where she came from. You get the impression that this is how she's perceived, whether she's wearing the hat or not.
Right.
And that is very much an Ali Fury Eats the Soul thing. But I started thinking about Fassbinder right away, not from the opening shot, but as soon as the action picked up in the bar, the lighting and the quirkiness of the characters and the fact that they look strung out. Mm-hmm. It's very much like the kind of thing you'd find in one of his movies. And he made a shitload of movies. If you know anything about Fassbinder, it's the kind of incredible, kind of appalling factoid that he made more movies than years he was alive. And I'm talking feature-length movies. Yeah. He died in his like early 40s and made upwards of 40 movies. It's nuts. Anyway, so I've seen way less than half of those. So take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt. But that's the vibe I was picking up from this movie from the word go, sure. More or less. And I think it's something that the movie invites because it is about the immigrant experience in no uncertain terms.
Yeah, I don't think that's a baseless comparison by any means.
That word polyglot is permanently polluted for me because there's a phrase in an H.P. Lovecraft story. You want to talk about horror creatives who think that foreign languages are automatically scary. I said before, it's kind of an American movie thing. His fiction is full of it, too. There's a bit in his story, Horror at Red Hook, in which he is like at his most rabidly racist, which is saying something.
Right.
And I'm a Lovecraft fan, but you do have to call a spade,
yeah.
Obviously. He refers to a multi-ethnic, multilingual ghetto as a polyglot abyss. And that phrase polyglot abyss has been stuck in my brain like a burr for years and years. I think about it kind of a lot. It haunts me. And I thought that this... movies like this, Lewis isn't unique in this respect, but movies that are this light on their feet when it comes to multilingual characters kind of having a lot of crosstalk and just dipping out of languages and into other languages, especially since it's a horror movie, there's a little bit more of a Lovecraft connection there. It's a nice little refutation to that xenophobia.
Right.
I keep using the word polyglot, and I just want you to know that my soul incurs like a toll every time I say that word out loud. It's a great story, Horror at Red Hook. Horrifying story, in part because it's such a window into bigotry. It's more horrifying than he intended.
Sure.
Put it that way.
Normally, and this is going to make me sound like a bit of a moron, but fuck it. Normally, I get frustrated when I can't pin down the events of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's just the plot-favoring writer in me. I want to know, like, who's doing what. And that doesn't mean I don't like a mystery, say. But if a movie is, like, deliberately vague about what's happening at any given moment for purposes that aren't really meant to be mysterious, like, mm-hmm. it's not setting up a mystery to be solved.
Right.
It's going to be an unsolved mystery. That bugs the shit out of me.
Most
of the time.
I'm here for it when it's meant to engender a lingering sense of paranoia. Mm-hmm. Like 70s conspiracy thrillers do this thing rather nicely. I love that feeling of like not knowing. The Gene Hackman movie Night Moves is an insoluble mystery on a plot level. And I still like that movie rather a lot because it leaves you with so many unanswered questions and you feel like a detective who really dropped the ball. Like, you really fucked up. This is not... It gives you that feeling of failure that you get at the end of, like, The Conversation or Chinatown. But the failure is arguably even more profound because you can't even say what happened. Like, right. You failed the most elementary test for a crime solver or, a detective. Anyway, that's not a horror movie, but that's the kind of movie where I feel like you can get away with that sort of thing. And some horror movies can pull that off also. But I'm with you. If it's murky just for the sake of like, oh, it really makes you think, that can be obnoxious at times.
Yeah, and I...
A little of it goes a long way. Let me put it that way.
Side note, I just have to say this. Harry says if you call him Harry one more time, he's going to make you eat that cat.
That movie's full of great lines.
Night Moves for the uninitiated. But yeah, no, I agree that I like that in a I basically have the same exception that you have.
Right.
Like, I like that in a 70s crime thriller or mystery or political thriller. Parallax View also doesn't really get resolved that tidily.
Right.
Although a little bit more tidily than I expected right at the end.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, in a movie like this, more often than not, it's annoying as shit. And that's how I thought I was going to feel about this movie, maybe for the first 20 to 30 minutes, even as there were things happening that I generally liked. But eventually, I came to grips with it, and I ended up liking it. Now, maybe part of that is the fact that I did
a lot of house cleaning.
I did eventually put together a framework.
Right.
But yeah, it did surprise me a bit, the extent to which I ended up appreciating the ambiguity, mostly because it wasn't there just for, like, film nerd masturbation's sake, I guess, is the point. Like, it was there for, like, Rashomon purposes, like you were saying. You know, there's different perspectives, and none of them really necessarily saw things the same way.
But there's enough middle to that Venn diagram where you feel like you're not completely out to sea.
They didn't all see it the same way because either they just only happen to see certain parts, or they have ulterior motives or feelings that color their perception of events. Obviously, the demon's going to want to sell his side of the story a certain way, and Luce is going to feel differently, and so forth. So it all worked for me, and I was glad that it ended up panning out.
And it ends on an appropriately kind of apocalyptic note with the, you know, please God, don't let it get away. That feels like a harbinger of doom.
Right. That's like on par with if the thing escaped from the polar research station.
Yes, exactly.
At the end of the thing.
Yeah. The
very much that.
Very much so.
So I guess we can get into our recommendations now.
Yeah, I reckon so.
And we've kind of done obliquely some of this already, but...
Well, as with the Sputnik episode, you recommend Alien first just to get it out of the way. Here, go watch The Exorcist.
Sure. Another movie that I was reminded of by Luce that I like a lot and that involves possession and is relatively low key for most of the runtime until there's a climax, but even then it climaxes in a different way that's somehow still mostly more low key even than Luce is. I'm rambling. Fallen.
Oh yeah,
with Denzel Washington.
You know, I thought of Fallen when I said there's no demon POV shots in this movie.
Right. So
it's like
so
basically
did I.
The only thing I don't like about Fallen, which is otherwise I know a favorite of yours, and I'm rather partial to it also.
Right. The basic premise of Fallen is that Denzel Washington is this cop who has put this serial killer on death row and then watches him get executed, and then essentially. And this isn't really a spoiler because it is clear relatively early on in the film. The serial killer was actually just a normal dude possessed by this demon, Azazel, who can hop from person to person just by touch.
Right.
And under other circumstances.
They don't need to smooch like they do in this movie.
Right. And it lines up with Luce in that, again, it's low-key. And also in the sort of like police procedural sense.
Yes.
Because, I mean, Denzel Washington is a cop and does interview suspects or witnesses and is like trying to get to the bottom of this whole thing. This movie reminding me of that movie is a good sign for Luce because I love Fallen a lot.
I'm just deeply in love with 90s serial killer movies as a genre, as a phenomenon. There's such a particular breed, like any movie from the Clinton years where a killer with an over-the-top gimmick like taunts the detective protagonist and leaves a string of over-the-top crime scenes in his wake is just catnip for me. I love that stuff. And you know, the most artful, weighty one would be Seven, probably.
Right.
That's the high water mark. But I will throw on Copycat any given afternoon. I love them all. And then Silence of the Lambs is not a perfect example, but it is probably, it's definitely what ushered in that kind of renaissance, 90s serial killer renaissance.
Yeah, it is the progenitor, but it doesn't check all the boxes.
No.
It is different, as you would probably expect from a Jonathan Demme picture.
Right.
So
Fallen is very apt just into when it comes to the body swapping. I think that's more in keeping with Luz than either of my recommendations are going to be. I think I'm just going to keep leaning whole hog into the art house European side of the spectrum. The first movie I'm going to recommend is a kind of exorcist movie. It's Romanian. It's called Beyond the Hills. It's by the same director who did 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Okay.
There's a harrowing picture.
Yes.
so is Beyond the Hills. I like both of those movies a whole lot. Beyond the Hills is an exorcist movie that is, to my mind, 100% secular. I mean, it's about mass hysteria and about an exorcism gone awry in which, for my money, nothing remotely supernatural happens. It's just about the power of belief and what it can make people do. And it's a hard watch in a few ways. The ending in particular has really stuck with me, the very last line, the last shot. So less said about that, the better. So that's up there with my all-time favorite exorcist movies. And it is an outlier just because it is, like I said, totally non-paranormal as far as I'm concerned. My other recommendation, which is more ambiguous, but could be read as being totally terrestrial, is a Polish horror film, horror drama, I guess you would say, from the 60s called Mother Joan of the Angels, which I've been meaning to rewatch because on the basis of the opening 20-30 minutes, I was completely in love with it. And then it lost me a little bit, and then it kind of got me back, and it's been several years, and I would like to have a more definitive ruling than what just dribbled out of my mouth. It's about an investigation into a convent where a bunch of nuns appear to have become demonically possessed, but it's revealed that they might just be running some kind of scam. It might just be mass hysteria, or it might be more knowing on their part. They might be doing it for ulterior motives. They might just be play acting, being possessed. But then it comes down with, I'm not going to get into it. Point being, it's a movie that very artfully, I thought, treads that line between the secular and the supernatural. And it's not really clear what's going on, but in a way that I found pleasing and provocative. If you want to see... This is about three recommendations for the price of one, but this one's going to be very quick. If you want to see a movie in which nothing supernatural happens, that's about hysteria, that's completely mental, check out Ken Russell's The Devils. that's, again, about like witch burnings and about exorcisms, and the devil does not have a hand in any of it unless it's, you know, the devil that lives in men's hearts or whatever.
Sure, sure.
It's just totally... people doing horrendous things to one another for basically its entire runtime. It's like if Lucio Fulci helmed a production of The Crucible. It's totally batshit. So there's three recommendations on the kind of arty, but check out Fallen too. Fallen is a really good time.
Yeah. Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. Quick apology. The sounds of nature intruded rather aggressively into our recording this time around, in particular a downpour of rain and bird noises. So, sorry about that. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Loose official trailer uploaded by Screen Media Films. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, October 25th, and we'll be discussing You Should Have Left, a film that finds Kevin Bacon trapped in a house that's bigger on the inside.